A third part of the interview with Michael Matrenko took place in Alexandria, Virginia on August 29, 1988.
Okay. At our last meeting, I was going over the list of issues that DCM Jack Nicklaus instructed you to look into when you establish yourself in Tabriz. And one point had to do with the role of the Iranian military. You were instructed to look into the impact of the military bases installations located around Tabriz, their impact on the local economy. You were also to attempt to make contacts with military personnel and find out something about their attitudes, for example, how dedicated were they to the government. To what extent were you able to make contacts with Iranian military based on that
Iranian military personnel?
Yeah.
I had certain contacts, or I had a couple of friends who were doing their army service in Tabriz, but these were people whose families I had known, or whom I had known personally before I got to Tabriz. I had a sort of courtesy visit relationship with the head of the army base, with the head of SAVAK, with the head of the, you know, the police, but basically it was pay a courtesy call or see them occasionally at major functions. In general, the higher ranking military officers were under rules or under instructions not to have social relationships with American officials unless they had a very good reason for it, good clearance for it. Now, I did know quite a bit about the military bases because we had an army attaché. We had a large MAG mission, Military Advisory and Assistance Group. And we had an army team house in Tabriz, which I used to visit regularly. We had an Air Force team house too. And these were places where you could meet some Iranian military. Certainly you could find out a great deal about the American military who were assigned to Tabriz or the area. As the revolution picked up, my relationships with the military got much better. And by early autumn of 1978, I don't remember the exact date, I'm guessing September more or less, a small group of military conscripts were assigned to the Tabriz consulate to protect it. I got to know them very well and got to know their replacements as they were, you know, as their duty shifted. I got to know their commanders very well too.
What did you learn about their attitudes towards the Shah and his regime?
There were soldiers, there were military who resented military service, but in general I think that the majority of military that I was in contact with were rather firm supporters, if they thought about it at all. But I'd say quite loyal supporters.
What did you learn about in terms of the civilian community in that area? Before the revolution, say before January 78, mm-hmm. or around thereabouts, what did you learn about their attitudes?
Before January of 78 or January 79?
I guess in the course of 77 while you were there, and you know, into 78.
The city of Tabriz was not particularly pro-Pahlavi. It never really had been. You have to distinguish between people that I would meet, for example, socially, the richer merchants, some of the officials, teachers, people of that sort, the local doctors and lawyers, people who had business with the consulate. They were generally very circumspect in what they said. What I learned about the regime, I usually learned from Iranians who had spent longer periods in the United States as students, or from my old friends whom I had met in the Peace Corps and with whom I maintained contact. my first Peace Corps site fell into the Tabriz Consular District, and I paid it several visits as a consul, basically because I enjoyed going there. But I was getting a great deal of anti-Shah sentiment and comment from old Peace Corps friends, people who knew me not as the American consul, but just as an old friend. From them, a lot of anti-Pahlavi comment, a lot of anti-Shah feeling.
Now, the instructions did not make a point about making contacts with the traditional social classes in strata, the bizarre middle classes, the clerics. Did you develop contacts with those?
I had a lot of friends who were in the bazaar, certainly. But the bazaar, it's not so easy to put. I mean, we talk about the structure of Iranian society as though it's rigid. It is a very loose flowing structure. Someone who is in the bazaar might have a brother who was a policeman, might have another brother who was a member of the clergy, might have a nephew who was an academic, and might have another, you know, a son who was studying in America, might have a cousin who was in the military. It's families were not at all that rigid socially. Because I was out almost every night or had Iranians into my home, either one or the other, almost every day, I knew people in just about every category except for the clergy. I met clergymen occasionally, but my attempts to get to meet some of the others, the leading clerical figures of the city, to get into some of the mosques were absolutely unsuccessful.
I made an effort.
Yeah. I was told immediately that I would not be welcomed. And as a matter of fact, one of the uglier aspects of Shiite Islam as practiced in Iran is that basically foreigners were not allowed physically to go into the mosques. In general, this is not true of the major tourist mosques in Isfahan, perhaps. It was certainly true in every small town, every smaller city. You could not go into one. And the attempts that I made to meet some of the clergy were simply not successful.
Now back in 75, the Shah had established a one-party system controlled by the Rastakis, a resurgence party. How did this organization manifest itself in Tabriz? Or to what extent did it manifest itself in that area?
Let's see. Yeah. Tabriz had a Rastakis headquarters. I knew a couple of different people who had been directors of the Rastakis party there. They were basically, how do I say this? The Rastakis party I never took seriously as any sort of political expression. It was basically a way for the ass kissers to continue kissing ass. I had no political role other than to serve as a rubber stamp for the Shah. The membership was totally artificial. The leadership was not elected or selected by anyone other than the Shah and his closest advisors. The positions in the party itself, as far as I could see, were simply sinecures or temporary assignments for people to earn money. There was no expression of political fervor or belief. And I met a fair number of the leaders of the party, either in Iran, in Tehran, or in Tabriz. None of them were, that I can think of offhand, were noted particularly for their political acumen or their patriotism or their willingness to serve Iran or anything else. It was just another job. No one was a fervid or fervent follower of Rastakis. I mean, it just would have been absurd to think of it in those terms. It didn't attract anybody who was interested in either idealism or serving his country or anything else.
Apparently earlier, I guess in the mid-70s, was used to some extent as sort of a policing mechanism to control prices in the Bazaari. And was that kind of thing going on while you were there?
The one example I can think of where it really impinged on the daily life of people is that during the huge construction boom, the Rastafis party, at least in Tabriz, was given the right to assign cement quotas or from government production. This was a wonderful opportunity, of course, for graft and corruption on the part of the people who were able to decide who would get cement. Other than that, it's, I think, rather noteworthy that the Rastafis party headquarters was one of the first buildings attacked in the first demonstration in Tabriz. It was a disliked organization, which had nothing at all to do with the aspirations or the political life of the people.
Now, around the time you arrived in Iran, 77, the country's economic managers, I think, were trying to cool down the economy in order to deal with the inflationary problems created by the oil boom earlier in the 70s. Did this cooling off process have any kind of impact in Tabriz? I think in other cities there was higher unemployment in the course of 77.
It's difficult to say. There was always a great deal of unemployment in Iran. The employment structure there, the family structure, the basic economic units are different than what we have here. People would live together in larger groups, and one person could be responsible for far more people economically than would be the case in the United States. If you walked out into any major city in Iran at any time of the day or evening, there would be huge crowds of men walking the streets, sort of aimlessly. There was a great deal of unemployment. Life, at the same time, was very expensive. I think the people who were unemployed, and I don't have any figures, you could simply see this on the streets if you walked out, hundreds or thousands of employable bodies were just walking and staring at shop windows and going into the cinemas in the middle of work days. I assume or believe that, you know, this disparity between lack of work and high cost of living was meant simply by sacrifice and sort of low living standards. The crowds of unemployed, or the crowds of underemployed, if you prefer, of course, were wonderful fuel for the revolution once it started.
Now, later in 77, and that fall, there were anti-Shah demonstrations at the campuses in Tehran. Were there any protests at the University of Tabriz?
The University of Tabriz was basically closed from late 1977 up through the revolution and, you know, 1979. It would be open for a couple of weeks, close again for a month or two, open, close, but it was basically closed all through 1978. Mm-hmm. And when it did open, there would be demonstrations or trouble and it would close again, or schools would close again, particular branches of the university.
So there had been protests in 77.
Yes. There had been protests. They weren't talked about a great deal. But it was already a non-functioning educational system, at least higher education. It's one of the reasons, by the way, that so many young Iranians wanted to come to the United States to study. If you were to stay in Iran and try and complete your 4 years of university education, you could assume it would take 6 to 7 years for the four-year period, just because schools were going to be closed. They were closed when I was there in the Peace Corps of the universities in the earlier 70s. They continued to be closed off and on during the mid-70s. Certainly by the later 70s, they were closed frequently. And if you were a serious student and could afford to get out of the country, you did it, if you wanted to finish the university. Otherwise, it was an open-ended prospect. Which is also, it was also true for Turkish schools at the same time and for other universities. We have a luxury in the United States. We know here that if you start school 4 years later, you're going to finish. Just let me.
A minute ago, you were talking about the crowds of unemployed people in interviews. To what extent did you, at the time, or you know, around those, in that period of time, see the revolution as having partially economic origins?
A very strong effect. How do I explain it? Let me give you some examples first. The sorts of people who were talking to me and the reasons why they had become disaffected, the economic reasons why they had become disaffected from the Pahlavis. From one old friend whose father had been a village landlord, he had owned a village up until the period of the White Revolution, which took away the land of the middle class landlords and distributed it among the peasantry. Well, this man had grown up fairly well off, and then his father had lost the family village. It was simply taken. They were given a little bit of money in exchange for it, but the money disappeared immediately. And the Shah's White Revolution meant that this family had lost everything. He took me once, when I was in the Peace Corps, to see the site of his former house. It was in the middle of a rather bustling village. It was a grand old house in total ruin. It looked like something from the Civil War, just a big Iranian sort of squire's house, and walls fallen in, etc. You could see homes like this, ruined large mansions all over the country of Iran. Now, he had been bitter about the Shah ever since then. As soon as other people began expressing their bitterness in public, he jumped on the bandwagon, even though he was a fairly highly ranking bureaucrat himself at this point. That's an example of, you know, some of economic reasons, but the economic reasons went far back into the past for him.
Old grievances. Yeah.
But old grievances and economic grievance. Yeah. Yeah. Another friend who was a member of the Shah's escort, policeman who was a member of his land, I mean his, what they call the ground escort. When the Shah would travel by land, by car, this was one of his escort. He'd grown up in a fairly poor family, small town, and used to talk to me about the disparity in his income and the incomes of those people he could see around the Shah. And as he said in, this was in 1977, he told me this, in April of 1977, roughly, a year before trouble really started happening. He said, why should I, as a policeman, a police officer, why should I protect people who have Mercedes-Benzes and houses in Shemaran in North Tehran? Now, he himself was a bit of a maverick. He used to love stopping Mercedes-Benzes and giving people traffic violations. He would never stop a Paycan, one of the cheaper Iranian cars, but he loved hassling the rich. But he was not alone. There were a fair number of people like him, very sharp, intelligent, the Young Turk type. Young Turk, referring to that period in Turkish history, who were very upset at what they could see as their prospects contrasted to what they could see the sleazy rich had gotten. Certainly an economic reason there. He, by the way, was living as a police officer, living with a roommate in a sort of walk-up, cold-water, semi-slum. On his salary, he could never have afforded a car, a refrigerator, a television. His parents gave him a couple of things like that for his house, but he couldn't purchase them himself. If he had tried to live on his salary, it would not have been possible in the city of Tehran, and he was an officer. You have people like that. I could go on like that, but I think you're getting the idea.
Yeah.
An awful lot of new glittery money hit Iran with the oil. And it was advertised all the time on television, it was advertised in newspapers. It never really got down to the lower classes. And a lot of them were beginning to resent it very much.
That's interesting.
Now, one of the turning points in this whole period was when Tehran newspaper, early January 78, published an article criticizing Ayatollah Khomeini. This is on January 7th, 1978. This, mm-hmm. this piece was published in a Tehran newspaper.
It caused a big outburst in Homs, and 40 days later, the outburst in Tabriz.
Mm-hmm.
The outburst in Tabriz was really the beginning, because it saw massive destruction of buildings and took 2 days. It was also heavily covered by the press for the first time.
Before we get into that, were there any demonstrations in January in Tabriz?
Not that I know of. No. There may have been something small, but it was not in the press. I never heard about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you witness any of these events that you were just describing?
No,
what did you witness yourself when you were in Tabriz? What did you see?
On
February 18th, I think? February 18th or 19th?
No, I was there certainly then, when the city of Tabriz lost 70 or 80 buildings, mm-hmm. including the Rastakhiz party headquarters,
mm-hmm.
which no one mourned, lost most of our banks, or a great number of banks. Other government buildings were badly attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And for several days, you could see the sort of debris on the streets.
You were saying? What social groups were involved in these demonstrations? From your...
what social groups? Let me give you an example. I had a security guard of local police, three policemen, three sergeants who were assigned as my security force. I mean, my personal body, security for my body. And they would show up every day. They were sent over by the local Kalantari, the precinct headquarters. I would come over, they would go over my schedule for the day, and they would escort me whenever I went outside the consulate premises. Now, normally I would simply tell them I wasn't going to do anything. They would leave, and then I would leave without them, because I didn't want them to be following me around. Anyway, when all the trouble started, they immediately were sent over by the precinct to sort of follow me around and make sure that nothing happened to me. After the rioting had been going on for a couple of hours, and we started to realize how serious it was, I wanted to get rid of them. I basically didn't want them there because they were going to attract attention. So I told them to please go back to their own homes, that I was going to go into the consulate and I was going to stay there, and I didn't really need them. I was thinking about them, actually. I figured that they'd be... I knew they were worried about their families. Nobody knew what was happening in the city. And my part of the city was so close to the army base, I figured nothing would happen there. Well, they left. 2 or 3 days later, two of them showed up, and I asked where the third was. And one of them said, well, he is in a little bit of trouble. He can't come back. Well, where is he? Well, he's in prison. What do you mean he's in prison? Well, sir, when you told us to go, back to our own homes 2 days ago, he was passing by and saw the crowd attacking the Rastakhiz party headquarters, so he joined in. I said, he was a policeman. Yes. He said it wasn't so bad that he joined in, but he also took part in the looting of the building, and they found a piece of furniture in his house. As it turned out, I spoke to the lieutenant governor, got him out of jail, but they would not let him come back to be my guard. That was the deal we worked out, that they would set him free because of my character reference for him, but they wouldn't let him back to the consulate. When you ask what kind of people, there's a good example. Why did he do it? Well, a police sergeant in Tabriz made a starvation salary.
Were, for example, middle-class professionals involved in the demonstrations at this stage?
At this stage,
more the Bazaari and
it was more the younger males, and a lot of the religious groups,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily led by the clergy, mm-hmm. but the prayer groups, the people who would, who were banded together. in small religious meeting discussion groups. And also, of course, the people who would join any crowd because it was a crowd. As far as I remember, that particular day or two in Tabriz, there were about 70 or 80 people killed. I had the figure later from the deputy governor of the city. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember now what he had told me, but it's a figure that goes back 10 years in the past, so we don't, but it was more, it was 70, 80, something of that nature, which is quite a number.
It's said that the local army garrison refused to fire on the protesters. Another version, it was the police that refused to fire. Did you hear anything about
in Tabriz?
Yeah, yeah. That's what I've read in various versions of the incidents, that if the police or the local army garrison refused, or parts of them, refused to fire on the protesters because they had relatives or friends or whatever. Or sympathetic.
They may have refused, but then how did protesters keep getting killed?
Well, maybe they had to ring in other people from outside the area for us to...
on this particular day, again, according to the Far Mandar of the city, which is the governor of the city as opposed to the state governor or whatever, there were 70, 80 people killed.
Oh, I've read that. Yeah.
And that was done by local soldiers and or local police. Mm-hmm. Not my police, of course, who were busily looting, but other police and the soldiers, the gendarmerie, whoever. As time went on, people continued to be killed on both sides. It was not, you know, only police or only military killing demonstrators. It happened on both sides. Mm-hmm. And there were a fair number of assassinations of government officials, police officials in this period. Mm-hmm. So it was working both ways.
How did you analyze the situation at this stage? What was your take on the significance of these demonstrations? And
I wrote a long aerogram memorandum describing what had happened, the extent of the damage, the casualties, the estimates, basic description of who had done what, and concluded by saying that there were social and political and economic reasons why this was going to continue, and that there was a religious dimension to it as well, that the demonstrators, the protesters, were calling out the name of Khomeini, and described who Khomeini was. Now, I've read the telegram or that aerogram again in the last year. It was very accurate. I sent the telegram, or the aerogram rather, 8-9 pages, whatever the number of it was, up to Tehran, and the embassy did send it out intact. They added something to the end after my signature. They added a line, something to the effect that the embassy political section does not agree with the above analysis, and for, you know, the embassy's analysis of what happened, please see such and such a telegram. Mm-hmm. But they sent it out.
Mm-hmm. Did you get any kind of direct response from the embassy? Did they?
Oh, certainly. I was on the phone the whole time it was happening.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a little bit of interest, not as much as there should have been. I think, though, that everybody was pretty shocked by it, but then assumed that it was something that was just, you know, in the exceptional variety and would not happen again,
but episodic. Yeah. Now, 40 days after the killings of Tabriz and the demonstrations that you described, mm-hmm. there was another period of nationwide mourning at the end of March, and there were more protests and more killings in various cities around Iran. In another cycle, 40 days later, mm-hmm. more demonstrations, I guess in early May. How did the situation in Tabriz change?
The security situation in general?
Yeah, political security, the state, the demonstrations, extended demonstrations. Were there more demonstrations 40 days later in Tabriz?
There were demonstrations in Tabriz off and on from then until 1979. Mm-hmm. There were still demonstrations going on in Tabriz in 1988. But certainly, it opened up the whole political demonstration you know, sort of cycle. Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of things being written on walls, anti-American, anti-American government, anti-Pahlavi government. One of the most interesting effects of all of this was that it suddenly opened up conversation. So that in the past, if I had gone to an upper middle class dinner party, conversation was going to be limited to things like vacations, art, you know, whatever, travel, and nobody would ever mention the name of the Shah. But conversations among, you know, academic friends from the university, the professional crowd that I used to see quite a bit of, even little old housekeepers, suddenly became very political. Everyone was talking about politics, and everyone was discussing the Shah, the Pahlavi family. It had just opened up Pandora's box, and they didn't care, they were discussing it openly. This was a total reversal. Before, things like that would always be discussed in small, private, secluded places, and it was, you know, if you discussed the Shah or his family, it was almost as though you were doing something obscene. You felt guilty doing it with Iranians. But suddenly everybody was talking about the future of Iran, what's happening, the relationship with other countries, religion. And it, the demonstrations did that. They took the lid off. Mm-hmm. I think it was then that Iranians started talking to each other. And that was the beginning of the end for the Pahlavis, who had survived that long by making sure Iranians did not talk to each other.
And you reported these kinds of conversations onto,
sure,
onto the embassy?
Oh, yeah.
Union?
Of course.
Not
every conversation.
No, but
just
out every night.
I mean, every day, every night I was out or dealing with Iranians or, you know, living Persian. But the significant ones, yes. General sort of wrap-ups, whatever, yes. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
The general general.
Yeah.
I've read in the Washington Post, they had a long series of articles some years ago about the revolution and the State Department's response. And one suggested that some of your reports had been held up by the embassy or diluted in some way by political officers in Tehran. Was that? Is there anything to that? Or?
I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
All of it. Okay, now, one thing about that. Normally, from a consulate, there are very few ambassadors who will allow consulates or consulates general to report directly to Washington. In almost all cases, the reporting comes through the embassy. And it is screened there. This was certainly true in other countries I've been assigned to. It had nothing to do with the personalities of the people assigned to the consulates. It's just that ambassadors, once they become ambassadors, become territorial. Their territory is the entire country. They don't want consulates or political officers in the consulate setting themselves up as minor embassies. All of the reporting, I don't know if anything was ever held back. I think that most of it did eventually reach Washington, but the reporting from one consulate or from one person would not normally be given a huge amount of attention anyway. There's simply too much paper. There was too much paper then, and there were 100 alternate sources for information about what was occurring in Iran. No one in Washington, in the government, on the policy side, can say that they did not know what was happening there. Invalid. There were newspapers and magazines and, you know, academic articles and 1,000 conferences going on and visitors, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anybody who wanted to read 100 pages or 1,000 pages a day about Iran in 1977 could have. All they had to do was sit down, go to a library, and do it. Certainly there was, the country was covered extensively in the media. It always had been. And there was a huge selection of material available and constantly being renewed. there were also huge numbers of Iranians here who were quite happy to talk and to express their dissatisfaction with what was happening in the country. So, you know, whether or not a couple of reports, a couple of telegrams were delayed, held up, it's not really important. Mm-hmm. These are just drops in what should have been, what was an ocean of information.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, in early April, I guess around the 9th, there was a big pro-government rally in Tabriz, at which Prime Minister Muzaffar addressed. Did you witness this rally?
No, I did not. Rallies of that sort, you could always watch them on television mm-hmm. or hear about them immediately. But in general, I've attended certainly enough ceremonies, and especially when I was a teacher in Iran and the Peace Corps, was required to attend demonstrations and things of this sort fairly frequently. You know, the Shah's birthday celebrations and celebrations in honor of various days. For rallies of that nature, or any political rally in Iran, it was a very standard way of getting crowds of people, factory owners, shop owners, people who control masses of people. School supervisors would be told that their staffs were to come to the rally, bearing, you know, the appropriate placards or banners or signs or whatever. And I asked one good friend who was a businessman in Iran who employed 20, 30 people in his business. He had a distributorship for whatever. He said that we were talking about how you get people to the rallies, and he said it's very simple. He said, they don't come and order me to send 20 of my staff to the rally. Said what they do is they inform me about the rally, and they'll tell me that they hope they'll see me there, and that I'll bring people from the office or from the factory. Mm-hmm. He said, if I don't do it, they don't say anything to me necessarily the next day or the next week. But when it comes time for my taxes to be done, I'm reminded of my participation or lack of at the rally, mm-hmm. and a different valuation is placed on my property, or when I need a license of any sort. He said there is a sort of follow-up to it, and you learn very quickly that if you don't want to be hassled, and you do want to get your licenses and your permits, you simply send people to these rallies carrying placards and signs. Mm-hmm. But, it's not too different in the United States or anywhere else. Certainly from the surrounding villages, the surrounding small towns, you could see people being bussed in with all the placards and the signs they were going to be holding. You know, I'd see the same thing in Poland when I'd go to rallies, same thing here, to a lesser extent here, but certainly, you know, still true. It's the standard way of attracting a crowd. Who would attend a political rally otherwise, for God's sakes? You know, people are busy. If they have a holiday, they want to enjoy it.
Yeah. Now, around May or June, Ambassador Sullivan authorized contacts with opposition figures, people organizing demonstrations, opposition politicians, to get a better understanding of their political views and their plans. Did you get any special instructions to widen your contacts with the Shah's opponents? People were politically active organizing demonstrations and so forth.
Did I get special instructions? No. Did it ever occur to me that I should not be talking to people like this? No.
Yeah.
As it turned out, a fair number of people I knew well were actively involved in the demonstrations in the revolutionary movement. I didn't make a conscious effort, it's just that I knew people like that, and we continued our relationships, but that I would start thinking of them as people about whom I should be reporting specifically. Or, you know, their attitudes, their opinions. There was one point at which I was approached by a leading religious figure's emissary and asked if a meeting could be arranged. I reported that to the embassy. The embassy told me not to. They already had a contact with the person. Or at least I think they had one. Or also possibly the political section in the embassy didn't want anyone to breathe, so breaking in on what they thought it was being their turf. But what kind of groupings were active? Was it, for example, there was a liberation movement for Iran that Lazagan and others were involved. Did they have representatives in the Tempuris, for example, or what kind of...
Yeah, the National Front people is the group you're referring to. I knew a fair number of people who were associated with the National Front. They became far more vocal, far more active as the year of 1978 progressed. I also knew people in the military who were becoming anti-Shah and who stayed in the military afterwards, or in the police afterwards. Various people began changing publicly in the sense of becoming, what's the word, more open in their statements and their condemnation of the regime, in their support for the demonstrations. And a fair number of these people are still there, are still in their positions, still in their jobs, still running the university or various hospitals, or you know, still in the police force and the army, the navy, whatever.
What was the political atmosphere like over the course of the summer of 78? Did it change? Did the cycle demonstration continue in Tabriz, or were there moments where there was no activity?
There were certainly weeks and weeks where there was no activity whatsoever. Tourists came to Tabriz. Again, people went on vacation. Schools were dismissed. You know, I had a whole series of visitors from the United States. It was quiet enough in general that my own parents came and stayed 3 or 4 months with me in Tabriz and didn't leave until, as far as I remember, October of 1978. It was quite late when they left. But certainly, when you talk about a cycle of demonstrations, one factor to remember is that people become accustomed to things very quickly. It's like getting accustomed to changes in weather. You know, you get accustomed to curfews. You simply change your daily program, your daily schedule, to meet the curfew. You get accustomed to the fact that strikes in a particular factory have stopped the availability of a particular good. You get accustomed to the fact that the university is closed, or that it's open. You become accustomed to new traffic patterns, you become accustomed to seeing tanks on the streets, and you simply sort of forget that it wasn't that way a year in the past. You begin to get accustomed to seeing large numbers of soldiers standing around with weapons, and you simply ignore them when you're driving.
That was the case in Tabriz during the summer.
All of these things were happening, and it happened in increments so that it wasn't really noticed. It's like gaining weight. You don't gain 40 pounds in one day. Or losing, you know, anything. It's just incremental, and so you really don't notice it. Or if you notice it, it gets very bearable. If you had taken people in Iran from mid-1977 to mid or to late 1978 in one day, country would have gone into shock, but because it happened incrementally, everyone adjusted. Power also disappears incrementally, and the Shah was losing his grip that way too.
What was your assessment of the Shah's future around this time, say during the summer?
You have to. I always thought of the Shah as something sort of not necessary and not even really applicable anymore in Iran. It was always sort of a puzzle to me how he or his family could expect to stay on as, you know, he is the sort of dictator of Iran when he no longer had the education to compare with many people in his own bureaucracy, when he no longer had the, well, want to call it training to keep up with what was happening in the world, when so much of his prestige depended on people not finding out what he and his family were like. But where at the same time the government was sending out thousands of Iranians every year to study, to be trained abroad. And they would sort of expect them to come back, sending them out to the United States, to Germany, to England, to France, wherever, for 3 or 4 or 10 years, and then expect them to come back and sort of ignore everything they had learned outside of Iran. They were sending out the cream of the Iranian student crop, thousands and thousands of people, or students, every year, and sending them out of Iran for their formative years.